Once upon a time.
What used Cinderella? The
festival.
What
used to go to the festival?
The festival. The King's festival.
Your family tree would always be a barren one.
Rapunzel, Rapunzel, let down your hair to me.
Well, these are no ordinary beans, son. These beans carry magic.
Magic? What kind of magic?
Tell him.
Into the woods you have to grope, but that's the way you learn to cope. Into the woods to find there's hope of getting through the journey. Into the woods each time you go, there's more to learn of what you know. Into the woods, but not too slow. Into the woods, it's nearing midnight. Into the woods to mind the wolf, to heed the witch, to honor the giant, to mind, to heed, to find, to think, to teach, to join, to go to the festival. Into the woods, into the woods, into the woods, and out of the woods.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Videos, this week on Broadway for Monday, February 2nd, 2015. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this evening are Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His new one is The Great Parade. It's going to be released on April 7th and available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Kritzerland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Hello, Peter.
Good evening.
Hello. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears to Talk in Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many of the places on the internet. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
With us today, we have a very special guest. Michael Urey is joining us by phone. Fans would know him from Broadway in How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, where he played Bud Frump. Our TV fans would know him from Ugly Betty, where he played Mark St. James. Off-Broadway recently, we saw him in Buyer and Seller. And now he's got something coming up where he's directing a production of What's Your Emergency on Stage 17. So, Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Very nice to talk with you guys. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So tell us about Stage 17 and What's Your Emergency. You know, what is Stage 17? We keep on seeing all these press releases come across from Broadway press reps to Broadway folks to this internet series. What has happened here?
Well, Stage 17 is a still newish internet platform that caters to the theater audience. It is a destination where there is original content and there is curated content. Each show, a different show, is a short-form series, either a scripted series like our show, What's Your Emergency. They've also got how-to shows. They've got a style show with George Brescia. They have a roundtable show where they bring together original casts and crews from Broadway shows, and Julie James moderates. They have a few other sitcoms like our show, and then existing web series that they've curated and that are available. But they're all short form, so it's all web series content. So everything is stuff you can watch and fits and starts, rather than longer form series television like you get on television, the real television. If anybody remembers how to watch real television, or like a Netflix or an Amazon. It really is a home for short-form web content.
So tell us about What's Your Emergency.
Well, What's Your Emergency is about the 911 call center in Hell, Michigan, and the people who work there. Basically, it's a high-stakes job with high-stakes situations and extremely low-stakes people. My partner in life and crime, Ryan Spahn, actually improvised a character in a class. And when he told me about it, I thought it was so funny that I asked him to write it down. And then he and Hallie ended up coming up with other characters to sort of stick with him, put in a world with this guy. And they all ended up working at 911 in Hell, Michigan. And they were all, some version of inept. And it's a workplace comedy with a regular cast of 10 incredible actors, some big Broadway names like Sierra Bagas and Reed Burney, Dead Monk, and other great people like Kevin Covert, who I did How to Succeed with, Aaron McCarson, Sekou Laidlaw, Dawood Hadami, who was in Tiger in Baghdad Zoo. And then each episode, you get a glimpse of some poor bastard in peril who's called 911. And those are all faces you know, like Lynn Cohen and Richard Kind, David Krumholtz, America Ferrera, Alan Cumming, so yesterday we had the entire series up all day because we were supposed to have a big press red carpet party and screening on Monday night. But there was an historical blizzard you may have heard about.
Yes.
And we had to cancel. But so instead of screening and showing all six episodes to a select group, we decided let's just throw them all up on the internet for a day and give everyone a snow day treat. So a ton of people watched. It was really fun. I watched myself in it, actually watching all the episodes back, binge watching all the episodes. It's really, really fun. So now that 24 hours is up, they've taken the episodes off. Only episode one is available now, and then next week we'll release a few more. We'll sort of tease it out for a little while, and then eventually all six will be available for binging purposes, or you can watch whatever episode you want. And I'm so proud of it. It's a very funny, tiny, mini TV show. It's a great little distraction, 6 minutes at a time, from your email, from your day-to-day computer stuff.
All right. Now, have you heard from anybody who really works from 911 who has seen it?
No, I think, but luckily it's far away from the reality of what anybody could imagine that mm-hmm. I don't think we're going to get into any trouble. Mm-hmm. We intentionally designed and shot the show to make it very clear that we weren't trying to imply that any actual 911 is like this. This is our own private version. Our own personal version of what 911 might be like in Hell, Michigan, which is a real place, by the way.
Now, given is it up a peninsula or a lower peninsula? Do you know?
I don't know. I don't know, actually. I did go there. It's a couple of hours away from Detroit.
Okay, it's probably lower. Okay, so the question becomes, given that you have actors in the series, needless to say, are any of the people's characters actors as well, and this is a day job for them?
Wait, what?
Okay, in other words, I would imagine of these 10 people who work at this place, that some are not in it as careers, that they're temporary jobs, day jobs.
I see. Yes. Are they? Do they have aspirations beyond 911?
Right.
Yes, I know one of our characters, actually, the one character in the series who's probably qualified for the job, has an MFA in filmmaking, uh-huh. ironically, with Andy, because this season is about the gang, the folks at 911 Hell trying to better their image. The numbers of 911 Hell are down. Emergencies aren't being dealt with properly in Hell, and they're getting some flack from corporate. So the first season is about the reporters. I'm sorry, the operators trying to do better and in any way they can. And one idea is that they have is to shoot a PSA. And poor Tim, who is very much aware that he's working with a bunch of idiots, he gets recruited to direct it, and that's one of the episodes.
Is anybody romantically linked? They say you shouldn't get involved with anybody at work, but people do. So
that's true. That you shouldn't, and they do. And the central character of the show is Sammy, whose dad runs. He's got the job through nepotism because his dad runs 911 Hell, and Sammy's in love with Janice, who's the mousy, quiet-talking operator played by Halle Pfeiffer. That's the last thing you want when you call 911 is a quiet talker, but Janice is. So we see them sort of dance around. Poor Sammy is extremely depressed, and his father is a nightmare. And he's in love with Janice, and trying to figure out the best way to go about asking her out. So that's another arc of season one. I don't want to give anything away, but it's very sweet.
Oh, then we won't ask you to. Now, Hell, Michigan is quite a bit away from Beverly Hills, California, and they were in Buyer and Seller, and you're the one who had to make it a hit because you were the first one to do it. Productions have spawned all over the country, but you had to do it right or else they wouldn't be happening. So when you first saw the script, did you say to yourself, yeah, this is going to be great, this is a winner? Were you confident of it? Were you surprised by the success of it?
When I first saw the script, I knew that it was totally hilarious, mm-hmm. and that if it worked, if an actor could make it work, it would be, it could be something really, really special, because it's such an enormous challenge. It's an enormous challenge for any actor and a feat to accomplish. And I thought I was capable of doing it, but I didn't know whether or not I would pull it off. And I was totally nervous about it. It's one of those plays that reads really, really well. When you read it, it's fantastic. And we were lucky. It was a nice big hit, and people really liked it. And I know that it's worked with other people since then. So I'm happy to say that, I was the first guy to make it work, but luckily I was right when I said yes, and we were able to figure it out. What's actually funny, I was scared. I was really nervous about it, not because, I mean, you know, partially because it was it's a little bit of a risk anytime you go sniffing near the Barbara Streisand world. You never know what, you know, who you might tip off or set off. And so I was a little bit nervous about that. But more than that, it's just a lot. I'd never done a one-man show before. I'd never really done something where I had to play multiple characters professionally. I come from a speech and debate background, and in high school we used to do things where we'd play multiple characters. So I had a vocabulary for it, but I'd never practiced it professionally. But when I was reading the script, because I read the script early on, and when I first read it, John, because I had been working with John on the sitcom, and when I first read it, John was like, I'd love you to play this part someday, but I wrote it for Jesse Tyler Ferguson. So when the first time I read it, I enjoyed it, but I did not allow myself to get remotely excited about it, because you know how things are. And then when it became real, I looked at it again on a plane, and I was with my partner Ryan, and I was like, you know, I just want somebody else to look at this, just to make sure they think I'm capable of it too. Somebody who knows me well. Mm-hmm. So I asked Ryan to read it at about a paragraph in, and said, I already think you should do this.
Now, am I the millionth person to ask if Barbara Streisand ever got in touch with you about this or came to see it?
No, you're the 2 millionth person. But it's a great question, and obviously I would want to know too. She didn't come. She knows about it. Mm-hmm. But she didn't come, and I think it's best that she didn't come. I mean, frankly, if you saw the show, you know that it would be really weird if she was there. It would be so bizarre if she was in the audience, and it would be and if nobody knew she was in the audience, I think it wouldn't be fair to her. Like, it's almost like if she ever wanted to see it, it would need to be all about her, and it would really need to be for her, not because. I just think out of respect, and I just think that's the only way it could possibly work. You know what I mean? It would have to be like the jester playing directly to the king, or in this case, queen, or else I just don't think it would. You know, I just don't think it would. It would really make sense otherwise.
All right. Now, many of us came to know you as a result of the Temperamentals.
Oh,
that surprises you.
I'm glad. I'm happy about that.
Well, here's my point. I was just talking to Michael Cerveris the other day. He's in a musical, Fun Home, in which he plays a closeted gay man, and he talked about the fact that after the show, the public theater where he was doing it had no stage door, so he had to walk through the lobby, and he was amazed how many people came up to him and told them their own life stories. And I'm wondering if you had the same type of experience, the temperamentals about the start of the gay movement, and there you are coming out of the stage door, are indeed older men there saying, boy, you really touched a nerve, boy, I remember this time.
Oh, absolutely! That was a wonderful part of that show. Doing that show, it's funny. Like the conversation when you do a play, any play, the conversations that are had after with anyone who sees it differ obviously from show to show. And it is interesting, you know, where Byron Seller was all about Barbra Streisand and hearing about what's, you know, people's stories about Barbra Streisand. Doing the temperamentals was. And Angels in America, I when I was in Angels in America too, you get a lot of experiences, people's experiences, specifically with the temperamentals. It was people's experiences with the early days of being out, and the early movement, the early political movements, had a lot of very interesting people come and talk to me about Harry Hay and Rudy Gernreich, people who knew Rudy Gernreich, which is the character I played, and Harry Hay, who started the Mattachine Society, which is what the Temperamentals is about, and then was later ousted from it, of course, like all great. And so we had, and then he went on to create a tamer political organization, sort of less aggressive, called the Radical Fairies. And we had a lot of fairies come, a lot of radical fairies come, which was really cool. People who knew Harry, I think his daughter came. But a lot of stories, a lot of the older generation talking, remembering, you know, and I learned so much about what it was like to be somebody who acknowledged being gay, whether or not they were quote unquote out. Was sort of, you know, most weren't, obviously, but, you know, there were, you know, there was a lot, there was a community, and it was really interesting to learn about it.
Mm-hmm. Now, how to succeed? Here you are talking about speech in high school. Did you do high school musicals? Did you do How to Succeed in high school?
No, I tried to get my, I begged them because I wanted to play Bud Frump in high school, and Nolan Noska could have played Finch, but they wouldn't do it. We did Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat instead. but Ralph Macchio toured How to Succeed through Dallas, the Des Machinoff production from the 90s. Mm-hmm. He toured that through Dallas. And I saw it. That's how I got to know that show. And so I hadn't done How to Succeed in high school, but I had wanted to since high school. And I weaseled my way into that job. Most of my jobs are some form of weaseling my way in. And that was no exception. I had met Craig Zaden and Neil Marin at an event, and got to know them a little bit, and had suggested it as something that they should do for television, because they'd done all those wonderful television. This is long before the live shows. They had done those wonderful television adaptations of Cinderella and The Music Man, and I suggested, I said, you guys should do How to Succeed on television, And so a couple of years later, when they were doing it on Broadway, I said, oh my God, those guys will definitely remember how much I like this and how much I wanted to do this.
Uh-huh.
And they in fact did. And that's how I ended up with that job.
Wow. How wonderful.
It was pretty great. I mean, you know, it wasn't quite that simple, but it was, one of those magical experiences. And then I did it, get to do it on Broadway for like 5 months. And it was the most fun I've ever had.
So how did you come across Suggly Betty? Was it a similar story?
It was. I kind of weaseled my way into that one, too. I replaced somebody in a production of the Revengers tragedy with the Red Bull Theater in a basement on Bowery Street.
Mm-hmm.
And after one of the performances, Will Cantler, who was a casting director at Bertie Telsey's office, who I knew a little bit from, you know, auditions and commercials and things like that, he stopped me and said, "You were great." And I was like, "Good to know. I'm never going to forget that Will Cantler said I was great." And at the time, I was illegally obtaining the breakdowns, the casting breakdowns, and I saw that he was casting a pilot that was shooting in New York, and I was doing something off another something off wherever, and I was like, "Oh, this would be good. I could keep doing my off thing. Maybe do this part in a pilot." The part was a co-star, which is less than a guest star, by the way, and it was bitchy gay assistant. That was the only thing it said, was bitchy gay assistant. And the part I played in the Avengers tragedy, I mean, it was a big Jacobean play. So it wasn't actually a bitchy gay guy, but the conceit of the character was sort of mean, rock concert, bitchy. I can't remember exactly what made me think that it was similar, but when I read Bitchy Gay Assistant, I was like, "Yeah, I could do that." And he would believe that I could do that. And so I could get this appointment. And so I asked my agent to get me the appointment, and they didn't want to, because I had already shot, another TV pilot the previous year as a series regular. And they felt like once you shot a series regular role, that you shouldn't go below that, which I think is totally crazy and very silly. But I was like, "Yeah, I know I was a series regular last year, but I spent all that money. Can we please? Can I please have another job now? And I don't care if it's it was a co-star part in, you know, money and credit only. The part was not bad. It was a good part." So they were like, "Okay, fine." And they got me the appointment. Will Cantler was like, "Yeah, I saw that guy in the basement." And he championed me, and I got the job. And then on basically the first day of shooting, Vanessa Williams and I hit it off right away. And she immediately helped me get screen time, helped me get, you know, in shots I wasn't supposed to be in. And she, you know, I was doing this sort of thing where I would like mimic her behind her. I would like, you know, sort of do the same physicality that she would do, but right behind her. And she saw me doing it, and I thought, "Oh crap! I hope she doesn't get upset." And she was like, "That's hilarious. What else can I do that you can mimic?" And like, you know, in hindsight, I totally get why she did it, because she knew that we were funnier together than we would be apart. But at the time, I mean, imagine you're doing a pilot, you're a big star like Vanessa Williams. This could be an opportunity for you to like have something hit, and you're going to share it with somebody else. It was really big of her to do that, because she could have very easily not. And still, you know, and potentially still had a big hit with it. But she chose to help me and really gave me that she really gave that to me. I really owe her. I owe her a lot because of that.
Wow, that's incredible. So tell us about your transformation from Texas to Juilliard, and then all over the world, and all the stuff that you're doing. So, what's the quick story? How did you make it out of Texas?
Well, I went to a public school in Plano, Texas, that had a great theater program and a great speech and debate program. And so, by the time I was graduating from high school, I was fully immersed in theater. I already knew a lot about the theater, and I knew that I wanted to make plays and somehow be in show business. But I didn't, at that time, I didn't really think that I had the talent to be an actor. And basically all I knew was the only professional show, the only professional theater artists I knew were my teachers, who I idolized. And so I thought, I want to be a drama teacher. And so my plan for a few years, for most of high school, was to be a drama teacher, to get certified as a teacher and, you know, find some great theater program and, you know, teach. And I still think I would have been very happy doing that. And so then I got really shitty grades and I was really bad on my SAT and I didn't get accepted to any of the schools that I applied to, which was sad. But at the same time, I was also starting, it was around the same time that I was also starting to think maybe I should try to be an actor, because at that point I hadn't ever really considered it a possibility, but I was doing really well in speech tournaments and winning a lot of, you know, trophies and for acting. And I thought maybe I could be an actor. And so I sort of took the bad SAT scores and getting rejected from all those schools as a sign. And there was a community college in town that had a great theater program that I was aware of. And they had been talking to me about coming there. And I thought, well, I don't think I want to do community college, but thank you anyway. And so after my scores were kind of lousy and I didn't get accepted to the schools I'd applied to, I said, why don't I just go there? It's a community college. I just, you know, if at the very least I can go do some plays with them and delay the decision about the rest of my life for another year or two. So I did. And then in an ironic twist of fate, my ACT scores, which if you're not aware, ACT is the alternative to SAT. Mm-hmm. It's like the shapes and colors version of the SAT.
Okay.
So those scores came back and I'd done really, really well and suddenly got acceptance letters to all those schools that had rejected me. But I had already made the decision to go to Quad C, and thank God I did, because I went on a field studies trip with them to New York, my first trip to New York, and we toured Juilliard. And after the tour, Brad Baker, who was my teacher at the community college, he said, are you going to audition for this place? And I was like, I'm really thinking about it. Yeah, maybe. And he goes, no, are you going to audition? And I said, okay, yeah, I will. And it was him, he's the reason that I auditioned then. I may have like gotten it together and auditioned a year later or something, but he was like, no, you can get in. This school is right up your alley. And so I did, and I got in, and it was crazy. It happened really quickly, actually. It all happened really, really quickly. And it was awesome. I had the most fabulous experience at Juilliard. It couldn't have been a better match for me personally. It was exactly what I wanted.
That's a great story of you know, a non-traditional path. A lot of people would have said, oh, you know, I didn't get it the first time, so I'm gonna go and do something else. But that's amazing.
Uh-huh.
That's just amazing.
Well, you know, I think I knew, once I knew this is what I want to do, I didn't really care. In some respects, I still don't really care how or in what position I do it. I knew I want to make plays, I want to make TV shows, I want to make movies, and I don't care how I'm involved. I just want to do it. And I think there's something very liberating about that. That I didn't know at the time. I was planning on being a drama teacher in a high school. So anything more than that, you know, anything more in depth or more involved or more, you know, I don't want to say professional because that's certainly a professional gig, but you know, anything, anything more like making a movie or more like making a play or acting on Broadway or whatever was just cake. And you know, everything above and beyond that was a dream come true.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for taking so much time out of your schedule to talk with us today.
My pleasure.
Listeners, we can check out Michael at michaelurie.net or on Twitter at Michael Urie. And also check out Stage 17. That's stage with the number 17.tv and all the great offerings that they have there. Michael, we will catch up with you again soon in the future.
I hope so. Thanks so much, you guys.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
All right, so let's start in with our reviews. Michael and Peter both got a chance to see the new Roundabout production of Into the Woods, which I guess I can't really call it the Roundabout production of Into the Woods, can I now? Michael?
Well, no, I guess not really. It's the Fiasco Theater production of Into the Woods being presented by the Roundabout at the Laura Pills. And this is, I'm trying to think if this is the first time... It's the first time that certainly that I can remember that a show has been done on a professional New York stage while the film, you know, which was just released, is still playing.
I think Chicago was playing when the film was.
Sure. Phantom 2, for that matter.
Is that what you mean? No, but I meant in reverse. What I mean is the film was released, and then they licensed this production to be done anyway, which was not already.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. So, which in the old days that would have been like, oh no, we can't do that because that cuts into the audience. But I think that people don't think that way anymore. And also, in this case, it's so different. I mean, it's almost apples and oranges. This is a very, very minimalist production. Sort of like story theater almost with, the cast, which numbers, let's see, only 10 people plus Matt Castle, the wonderful Matt Castle, on piano. There's a lot of doubling, as you might imagine, but also there are actors playing instruments, but not, it's interesting, not to the extent that they do in the John Doyle production. And most of the, in addition to Matt Castle, the other people who are primarily musicians, they do have lines in the show and they play characters. For example, the fellow who plays the mysterious man is primarily a musician, but so there's a little bit of an overlap, but not as much as in a John Doyle production. And they use props, like various props like you might find in someone's attic or basement to tell the story. There were no costume changes. They're not attired really as the characters would be in any sense like that. It's just a bunch of people putting on a show and being very incredibly creative about it. I thought it was extremely, extremely well done. The audience seemed to be with it 100%. They really loved it. I would say the only negative things I would have to say about it are the flaws in the show itself, which especially in, boy, it really gives me an appreciation for how much improvement was done in the film just by cutting so much of the second act primarily, and then also some other little changes in the script just to kind of tidy things up. This character of the mysterious man, I guess I never felt that he worked, and seeing him not be in the film, I thought was a brilliant idea. But then seeing him reinstated in this version just made me 100% think that was really never a good idea to begin with, and I'm glad they rethought it for the film. But it is so fascinating to see it, and I think as far as I could tell, you tell me, Peter, it seemed completely uncut. It was almost 2 hours and 45 minutes with the intermission, so which is considerably longer than the film, obviously. So it was interesting to see all that stuff put back in and to see what worked and what didn't work. They really made a case for the strengths of the show. I think they really did. It was a very, very strong cast all around. My favorite was of all of them, although everyone was good, was Milky White. I thought he was absolutely incredibly appealing and adorable, and I think the audience agreed with me. You could feel the reaction to him. It was so sweet, and the relationship between him and Jack. So I think it's, you know, and I'm sure, like many people, I have mixed feelings about minimalist versions of shows. you know, because so often, maybe always, the primary reason is really just to save money. But that doesn't mean that some of them don't work very, very well. And I think in this case, it really did. And it's interesting to see it in the context of having seen the film so recently. And then, of course, you can also compare it to the original Broadway production, which is preserved on video. So, you know, there's so much to be learned and from comparing different treatments like that. And I certainly did, aside from being really very, very well entertained by this really excellent company.
All right, Peter, what'd you think?
Oh, I adored it, too. I wondered if you had never seen Into the Woods before, if you might be a little lost here and there. But I'm not sure that that would be the case. I think they do a very good job of making you understand what's going on every step of the way, even with all the doubling. 10 performers, and it could have been 9, but thank God it isn't, because, yes, Milky White is terrific. I mean, you know, of course, originally in 1987, Milky White was this statue, is that what we call it? But here, you actually have this wonderful actor whose name, I guess, is Andy Grotel-Yushin. If it's not pronounced correctly, please forgive me, Andy. I always forgive people, and they don't get my name right, so I hope you will, too. And he walks on all fours. He walks standing upright with a white shirt, jeans, and he really has a personality. That's what makes it so nice. His reactions are so human. I mean, for example, when he hears that he's about to be sold, he winces. Though he winces much more when Jack says something stupid or does something senseless. I like that so much. He's a good soldier, though, when it's time to be sold, and that makes theatergoers feel for him in a way that I guess no audience ever before has.
He leaves with a little suitcase in tow.
Yes, right. And it's so great several scenes later when they reunite. Milky White gives Jack an enthusiastic, come here and embrace me type gesture with both hands, and Jack, of course, rushes over and hugs him. And when it's time for Milky White to go to cow heaven, he first grabs his left arm in pain, you know, suggesting an impending heart attack. And again, I felt the audience express sympathy, you know, which you don't expect, you know. So I thought that was very good, too. Now, maybe because they wanted to do Milky White, the character they sacrificed is the narrator. All the other characters take turns doing the narration here or there. In terms of the doubling, Mr. Grotel-Yushin and Mr. Brody play Cinderella's stepsisters in The Two Princes. And it's really delightful when they enter as the stepsisters, because there's a wonderful costuming decision here. They take a curtain rod, and from it they hang two curtains that are bisected, you know, like with sash ties. And so they look like dresses. So they hold the end of the rod, they place the apparatus under their chins, and suddenly they look to be in dresses and they become stepsisters. What I also liked when they were the princes, they prance on hobby horses. And but what was really great is when they see each other and now it's time to stop and talk, the horses are still actively moving, you know, the way horses do. You know what I mean? Yeah, the horses don't stop when you do necessarily. You know, they have a little more juice in them, and as a result, they're going to do a lot of stuff like that. So I like that quite a bit. The wolf is very cleverly handled. We do see the actor's face, but then he gets like the stuffed animal mounted on a plaque, that head, and he puts it in front of him, and that really makes a nice image. But wow, it really is impressive when we get to Granny's house, which is a sheet. Think of City on Fire and Sweeney Todd. And behind, you see Granny. And while she seems to be a woman at first, they put the head in front of the actor's head. And then you see the wolves. It's unfair to give away any more. I mean, I hope this is enough of an appetizer to get you to go to see, to have the whole meal, because it's so wonderfully imaginative. Well, I'm going to say something controversial here, and that is some years ago, some theatrical luminaries were asked to give their opinions on the greatest performances they'd ever seen, and Rocco Landsman, who was on the ground floor of Into the Woods, being involved with Jew Jamson, whose Martin Beck Theater housed the production, named Joanna Gleason as the best performance he'd ever seen an actress give in a musical. And I'm not going to argue that she wasn't wonderful, but I will say that I do think that the woman who's playing it now, Jessie Austrian, is better. So we'll see if you agree with that. Again, I do concede that those who don't know Into the Woods might be confused by this deconstruction. But in all the visits I've made to the show, 16 going on 17, I've never seen an audience enjoy it more than I did this one. Now, that may be because in the ensuing 25 years, 20, whatever it is, 29 years, that went fast, 27? You do the math. Anyway, it could be that they know Into the Woods. You know, sure, you know, it could be. But it also could be because this theater company really got into the woods.
I completely agree about Jessie Austrian. I thought she was wonderful. She's also one of the strongest singers in the company. The singing is not uniformly wonderful throughout. Some are stronger than others, but I thought she was really excellent. And I also would single out Jennifer Mudge as the witch. And I know I have seen Jennifer Mudge before, but I went through the credits and I'm not sure where, but she was really fantastic. They all just did yeoman work, and it's I agree with Peter that you should definitely try to get there if you can.
And it's in a nice small space too, which is good. Yeah. So even the worst seat is not a bad seat.
Yeah.
Jennifer Mudge was in Rocky. Do you remember?
Yeah, but I mean, I think I saw her. Yeah, she was definitely that was her most recent thing. I can't remember, but
I've seen her in stuff before and I can't place it either.
Yeah.
By the way, three times in the last week, not once, not twice, but three times I've met with readers, each of whom has said to me, call me crazy, but I loved Rocky, you know? And I mean, so it really is something now.
Crazy.
Wouldn't call them crazy because you like.
No, of course, that's my point. You know, I mean, all these people are coming out of the closet now to fess up and say that they like Rocky, but they were ashamed of it. They've been browbeaten by what happened, and as a result they sheepishly, if not guardedly, if not humiliatingly, give their opinion, expecting me to poo-poo it, you know, and they're happy to find that I don't. But it's like, really, it's almost like an AA meeting, the way they treat it, you know. They want to hug me for having this opinion, you know. And so who knows? Maybe Rocky will live again someday. Granted, it'd be a very expensive show to do, but even without those histrionics at the end, but still, you know, we may see Rocky again. I hope we do. Oh, by the way, may I point out, while we're here talking about Aaronson Flaherty, I didn't plan to say this, but in case on Monday night, February 9th, you want to see A Man of No Importance at NYU, I'm going to be doing a talk back afterwards with Lynn and Steve about the show. They're off-Broadway musical of some seasons ago. So it's not an expensive ticket. I think it's the highest one is 20, and I think you can get in for $5, depending on who you are, you know, like seniors or students or something like that. So consider next week, especially if you missed Man of No Importance, which really is a very fine musical based on a very fine movie. So maybe we'll see you there.
Let me ask the two of you, does this Roundabout often pick up whole productions?
I don't think so.
Well, you know, they do it more than yes. I mean, they do it quite a lot, to be honest. And yes, I mean, for example, Sunday in the Park with George, and Cabaret. I mean, you know, apparently there were substantive changes from the...
No, but that counts. You're right.
Yeah.
I don't see it as that many, but of course, there's no denying what you're saying is absolutely correct.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. I wouldn't say it's a huge percentage, you know, but it's certainly not unknown.
All right, so let's wrap up for the evening. If you stick around, we'll talk a little bit of trivia. But before we do that, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many other ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app. It's an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device. That way we can be streamed directly to you. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, Michael, or me can be found on the show page at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about. So, Peter, do we have an answer for last week?
All right, last week we asked the question, what famous Tony-winning songwriting team was writing a musical that had the name of a Broadway theater once upon a time? It's no longer called that theater. Well, the team is Bach and Harnack. They were working on a musical called Trafalgar, and indeed the Nederlander Theater for a year, maybe a little more, not much though if it was called the Trafalgar Theater. So the Trafalgar Theater on 41st Street became the Nederlander, and Bach and Harnack unfortunately did not finish the musical Trafalgar, which they were writing with the British playwright John Arden, about Lord Wellington and what happened to him at Trafalgar. I think you can hear a song or two from it, though, on that marvelous Harbinger record release of Sheldon Harnack Rarities. Just check out that album. It's really terrific. So that's the answer to that question. The question this week, all right, George Spelvin is the name that American actors use when they want to be anonymous. Mm-hmm. You'll see it in playbills when, for whatever reason, whether they don't want to admit they're in the show, whether they're equity and are trying to skirt around that, pretend they're not equity, that type of thing. So that's in America. There is a definite correlation. What's the word I'm looking for? There is a definite...
correlative?
Thank you.
Equivalent. In England,
good. I'll take it. In England, the same type of thing appears in British playbills, but it is not George Spelvin any more than it's Alan Smithy, which is the name that directors like to use in movies when they don't want to take credit or take blame. So what is the British equivalent of George Spelvin? That's the trivia question for this week.
All right. So if you have the answer to those things, go to the Broadway Radio page. There's contact information for Peter, Michael, and me, and let us know what you think. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Videos this week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Once upon a time, in a far-off kingdom,
to be happy and forever, you must see your wish come true.
Yes, I'm the cow, only two of the four.
Three.
Two.
Three. Compare this to your corn.
Where did you find it?
I pulled it from a maiden in a tower.
Happy now and happy hence and happy ever after.
Get me what I need. Get me what I need.
Ooh, what a beautiful cape.
Stay away from my cape or I'll slice you into a thousand bits.
Into the woods without delay.
Be careful not to lose the way. Into the woods, who knows.
Look, Milky White, it's the butcher.
Bah!
The baker.
Into the woods. Into the woods. Into the woods. And out of the woods.
We have to stay here and find our way out of this together.
And happy ever after.